Okay, we're going to get started now. What? Unlock it before I hit record? Okay. Okay, we're going to get started now. Last week, we took a whirlwind tour through early American history. There are three sort of takeaway points that I want to just emphasize again very quickly at the beginning. First point that we went on and we discussed in some depth last week was that from the 18th century, really until the mid-1930s, or at least until the New Deal in 1935, the federal government played a very minor role in the nation's health and welfare system here in the United States. And we really talked about three reasons for that. First reason, American political culture, the emphasis on limited government and individual rights. Second reason, the institutions set forth in the Constitution, in particular separation of powers and checks and balances, really the Madisonian interpretation of the Constitution that became dominant once Jefferson became president in 1800. So we talked about that. And third reason that we talked about last week in terms of limited federal role in social welfare was that what the country adopted was the English poor law system, under which local governments had responsibility for providing care and was providing care primarily to the deserving poor. So point one that we talked about last week was limited federal role in health and welfare for the first 150 years of the American Republic for the reasons I've just described. Second thing we talked about last week was the evolution of the healthcare system in that context. In particular, we talked about the rise of the doctor and the rise of the hospital in the late 1800s and early 1900s as the linchpins of the healthcare system. And then the third point that we talked about last week and where we ended actually last week was with sort of the policy dilemma that was created with, on the one hand, just extraordinary growth in the number of hospitals and the number of hospital beds in the United States, extraordinary growth in investment and dollars invested in hospitals, extraordinary growth in the amount of revenue in hospitals. I mean, prior to the early 19th century, there were relatively few hospitals. Most of them were public hospitals or charitable, religiously affiliated hospitals, which didn't charge any money and basically just treated the poor and the indigent who were unlucky enough to end up on the medical ward. After the early part of the 1900s, you had hundreds of thousands of hospital beds created in the United States, massive growth, massive new revenue, and then bang, you've got the economic depression, you've got the stock market crash, and there's this policy paradox in which you have all these new hospitals with all these new technological tools and all these new scientific advances, and people can't afford to pay the bill. So that's where we ended last week, and I think I introduced to you Justin Kimball and the Baylor Hospital story, and that's where we're going to pick it up tonight. The goal today is really to talk about the evolution of the private insurance system in the United States, the rise of Blue Cross, the rise of commercial health insurance, the early debate over universal insurance in the United States, the New Deal that Franklin Roosevelt tried to bring to the United States and created in the 1930s, and some issues and problems he had in making that come to pass. We'll talk a little bit about Harry Truman and his proposals and interest in national health insurance. And then we're going to talk about sort of the evolution of Medicare and Medicaid. And then we're going to talk about the Medicaid program and some issues, both the evolution of Medicaid over the last 40 years and also current issues on the Medicaid agenda. So that's the plan for today. I assume everybody was able to get access on CourseWorks to the, either has a course pack or was able to get access to it on CourseWorks. I believe it's up on CourseWorks now, at least the first several weeks. I think the book is in, the Covenant book is in the bookstore, and I hope everybody who wanted to get it was able to get a copy of that. If there are any problems accessing materials on CourseWorks, accessing the course pack or accessing the book, just let me know, either now or at a break, or we'll let one of the teaching assistants know as well, and we'll try to figure out what the problem is, and we'll take it from there. Any questions before we get started tonight? All right. As I think I mentioned at the end of last class, Baylor Hospital in Texas, in Dallas, Texas, was one of those facilities around the country that spent a lot of money in the 1920s building a new snazzy, fancy facility. By 1929, 1930, however, Baylor Hospital was in significant fiscal distress. Revenue was declining. It didn't look as if they could make the mortgage payments on the hospital. It didn't look as if they could pay for all the technology they had. And it wasn't really clear how Baylor, like so many other hospitals around the country, was going to be able to make it in this time of economic crisis. Justin Kimball was an administrator at Baylor, and Kimball had an idea. And Kimball had a proposal. What Kimball suggested and what Kimball implemented was a program in which Baylor went to the teachers in Dallas, Texas, the public school teachers in Dallas, Texas, and said to the teachers, you know what? You give us, each teacher gives us 50 cents a month. And in exchange for 50 cents a month, or $6 a year, we will allow you, the teachers, whenever you get sick, to come to our hospital for 21 days. And if you need hospitalization more than 21 days, we'll give you a significant discount off additional hospital days. But you get 21 days that you've prepaid for, in effect, with your 50 cent a day, 50 cent a month payment. So about 1,400 teachers sign up and agree to what is really the first prepaid service plan for hospital services in the United States. There have never been such a program before in the United States. Just to give you a sense of how it played out, I'll talk about the first person who ever used these services. Reading here from a history of Blue Cross. By December 1929, there were 1,356 teachers enrolled. The benefits became effective for the teachers on December 20th, 1929, the first day of that year's Christmas vacation. This is the dramatic part. It was not a moment too soon for Mrs. Alma Dixon, who slipped on an icy sidewalk a few days later and broke her ankle. When Dixon's doctor told her she would need a cast to put on the fracture, she was shocked. Quote, "I can't go to the hospital," unquote, she told him. Then the author writes, presumably clutching at her purse. I mean, I'm not sure. It might be a little, you know, with these kind of memoirs these days, you have to be a little careful here. But anyway, she was presumably clutching at her purse. The doctor responded, quote, "Aren't you a member of this school thing they're going to try?" She said she was, but she didn't know if it would pay her hospital bill or not. All she knew was that, quote, "Dr. Kimball's got another club he wants us to work at, and I paid 50 cents. Mrs. Dixon spent an all-expenses-paid Christmas in Baylor Hospital and went down in history as the first patient in the prepaid group hospital service movement that would later be known as the Blue Cross Organization. So Miss Alma Dixon was the first Blue Cross patient in the United States, although it wasn't called Blue Cross at the time. So Baylor Hospital creates this prepayment plan, this prepaid service plan. And it becomes a big hit because these teachers, like Alma, Mrs. Dixon, who really couldn't afford, if she'd broken her ankle and had to go in and pay the going rate to Baylor Hospital, she probably wouldn't have been able to afford it. But for the 50 cent payment, by pooling with all the other 1,300 some odd teachers in Dallas, all of a sudden it became affordable to her. And so other hospitals around Dallas and elsewhere begin to think, well, this isn't a bad idea. This might be a way of us actually raising enough revenue to survive financially. And Justin Kimball also goes around and says, all right, I got the teachers, but let me try to get some other businesses. So he gets the Dallas Morning News newspaper. He gets the local bank. Within a couple of years, he's enrolled over 400 businesses in the Dallas area, and there are more than 23,000 folks enrolled in this prepaid service plan. Pretty good idea. Pretty good idea. Seems to be working. And in fact, it rescues Baylor Hospital from fiscal distress. I mean, they have all this money. They have 23,000 times 50 cents a month coming in. People are paying this individually. The employer is not paying this. People are paying this out of their pocket, but it's actually affordable for people to pay it out of their pocket. And all of a sudden, Baylor's in a pretty good financial situation. But what are some of the problems with this system? What do you think some of the problems with this system were? Yeah. Well, first of all, the comment, in case you couldn't hear, was it's not good for travel. Yes, certainly if you go to Houston or if you go to San Antonio and you fall and break your foot, you have to make it all the way back to the Baylor Hospital. This only gives you service at Baylor Hospital, no place else. Yeah.
You're obviously creating incentive for more intense treatment. Like, why are you hospitalizing someone for a treatment?
So the question was, you're creating an incentive for people to show up at the hospital. And by the same token, you're putting the hospital at risk, at financial risk. I mean, now, sure, it sounds great to the hospital. You know, we get all this revenue in up front, 50 cents a month from these 23,000 people. But remember, we've guaranteed them 21 free days in our facility. What happens if they all start showing up at the facility and saying, you know, we have a cold, we want to stay here for 6 days? Or not that people would want to do that, but you worry, what happens if people start, if you've miscalculated actuarially, you know, what it's going to cost to break even? The hospital is now at financial risk, and hospitals have never before been at financial risk in that sense. They're in effect going into the insurance business. Hospitals had always been providers, they hadn't been insurers, and now they're at financial risk. What else? Any other thoughts on this? Yeah. You have to have what?
You have to have a job at one of the businesses.
You have to work. I mean, this is not for everybody. They were not offering this to the public in Dallas. It was only to folks from those 400 businesses or so that had signed up. Yeah. They did not cover the families of the people, so it was a limited plan in that sense. Yeah. There would certainly be what the economists would call the potential for adverse selection, which is that people who were sicker or thought they were sicker would be more likely to sign up than people who were healthy, which of course raises the risk for Baylor Hospital that they're going to have people show up for more than 21 days. From the member's point of view, from the patient's point of view, and this is actually related to the comment about what happens if you're in San Antonio, what happens if you're in Dallas, but your doctor is in another hospital? Under the Baylor plan, you got to go to Baylor. So there's a freedom of choice issue. Yeah?
How much is, if you said, like today's bank returns, like how much out of pocket?
You know, I'm not sure of the answer to that. I mean, obviously, it was a lot more back then than it is now, but it clearly was considered an affordable amount. Via inflation, though, I'm not sure. I know last week, I gave you some numbers which suggested that hospital revenues, the average hospital stay was about $240 for the average stay prior to the Depression, and then it sunk to about $60 after the Depression. So in effect, you're paying, you know, $6 a year for anywhere from $60 to $260 worth of hospital care, depending on the time period, you know, and the sort of the economics of it all. So again, it's... I think it was an affordable amount even back then, because again, the teachers were not sort of a wealthy population, but I don't know specifically the answer to the question. But so there were questions that teachers and beneficiaries raised about freedom of choice. There were questions that the hospitals raised about risk. There were questions that state insurance department officials raised about, you know, what is this thing? Is this an insurance company? Is it a prepaid service plan? What is a prepaid service plan? Do we regulate it? How do we regulate it? We don't know what to do about it. So there were lots of questions asked. It was a good idea, but lots of questions. And in fact, very similar kinds of questions to the questions that we're going to come back to, you know, 70, 80 years later when we start talking about managed care here in the United States and the rise of managed care, questions about risk and freedom of choice and the like. Yeah?
When you gave the example of the woman who slipped and broke her ankle and she was able to go Alma Dixon.
Right. Alma.
Alma. Okay, and she was able to go to the hospital. Did this plan provide for prescriptions?
No, all this paid for. This was not a health insurance plan. This was a hospital prepayment plan. So it wouldn't pay your doctor's bill. It wouldn't pay your drugs. It wouldn't pay your labs. You know, it wouldn't pay those kinds of things. It just paid the hospital bill. So it was limited, which was another concern, another complaint about it. In response to these kinds of questions and these kinds of issues from both the beneficiary's perspective and the hospital's perspective, a couple of things happen. First thing that happens takes place in Sacramento, California in 1932, I believe, 31 or 32. And what happens in Sacramento is two hospitals get together and say, you know what, we like Kimball's idea, we like what Bail is doing, but instead of having just each of us have one of these plans and have us then compete with each other, let's do it planned jointly so that anybody who buys into our plan gets to go to either of our two hospitals. Then they added a third hospital, and then quickly they added four more hospitals. So quickly in Sacramento, pretty much all seven of the hospitals were part of this plan. At that point, the local hospital association in California and then in New Jersey and elsewhere, the local hospital association says, you know what? If we're going to have these multi-hospital plans with 7, 8, 9, 10 hospitals all working together in a joint way, we ought to create a new administrative entity to administer and to operate these hospital plans. And so in New Jersey, they create the first one of these new administrative entities to operate one of these multi-hospital plans, and that entity is called Blue Cross. So Blue Cross begins, and then Blue Cross associations start around the country. Blue Cross begins via the efforts of hospitals to get paid. And insurance regulators say, you know what? Blue Crosses, we'll allow you to exist. We'll authorize you. We'll license you. But here's the deal. Here's the deal. What you have to do is you have to agree to be a nonprofit. You have to agree that at least 75% of the hospitals in your community will accept enrollees. You have to agree to accept anybody who wants to join. Open enrollment. You can't say no to people. And finally, you have to agree to what's called community rate, which basically means you have to charge the same premium, the same 50 cents a month or a buck a month or whatever it is, the same premium to everybody who wants to join. And so that's the deal. So these Blue Cross plans start around the country, and they're really the first hospital-based plans in the United States. They're started by local hospital associations. They all create these nonprofit administrative entities to run them. All the hospitals in the local community sign up. People pay a premium. In exchange for that premium, Blue Cross pays the hospital directly for the cost of hospitalization and their open enrollment and their community rate. By the end of the 1930s, there's about 1.5 million Americans across the country who have signed up in these Blue Cross plans. So they're starting to grow, but it's still a pretty small number. But they're starting to grow. Around that same point, mid-late 30s, some commercial insurance plans decide they too want to sign up for this new health insurance business. And the commercial insurance companies do it a little bit differently. See, because the commercial insurance companies don't have hospitals that they could provide free services in. So what the commercial insurances do is they offer what's known as indemnity plans. And an indemnity insurance plan, is basically a plan in which you say to an individual, sign up with us, go to any doctor you want, go to any hospital you want, go anywhere you want, you'll get the bill. Pay the bill to the doctor and then submit a claim to us and we'll indemnify you or we'll pay you the 80% of the bill that you paid or for whatever it is that we work out as fair payment. So you get these two different models, Blue Cross and then Blue Shield, because Blue Shield is created by the medical associations and the doctors to do the same thing that Blue Cross was doing for the hospitals. So Blue Cross and Blue Shield provide hospital and doctor insurance in the same way. You've got Blue Cross and Blue Shield in which the payment goes directly from the, in which the individual doesn't pay anything out of pocket. Basically, the payment goes directly from Blue Cross or Blue Shield to the doctor or the hospital. And then you have the commercial health insurance plans in which you basically sign up with the insurance company. You pay the bill, but then you submit a claim to the insurance company and get reimbursed by the insurance company. So two slightly different models. Doesn't matter all that much for our purposes, you know, how the two models vary. But those are the two models that begin to grow beginning in the 1930s. And it's really the taking off point of private health insurance in the United States. One other very big difference, though, between the commercial plans and the Blue Cross plans. The Blue Cross plans, as I just mentioned a couple of minutes ago, are required to community rate. They have to charge everybody the same premium, no matter how old, how young, what their health status is, who they are, etc. It's everybody in the same community, the same rate. The commercial insurance plans don't have to do that. And so the commercial insurance plans begin to what's known as experience rate. And what experience rating means is that you look at the individual or you look at the group and you say, well, this is a pretty healthy young individual. Well, this is a group of employees that's pretty young and pretty healthy, so we don't think they're going to have big medical expenses, so we're going to charge them a very low rate. Or you look at a group or an individual and they're older and they're sicker and they've got pre-existing conditions and you say, God, these guys, they're going to cost us a fortune, so you charge them a high rate. The charge that you impose is based on the likelihood of the cost being high or low of the individual or the group. So the commercial insurer's experience rate, Blue Cross community rates. Now, of course, what that means is over time, it's going to be very, very, very tough for Blue Cross to compete with the commercial insurers. And why is that? Yeah.
Well, because the insurance companies would have made a lot more money on charging a lot more for the like the populations that are likely to be sicker. Whereas if Blue Cross was charging a flat rate for everyone, then they would lose money because their population would most likely include the same demographic.
Right. Little by little by little, the commercial insurance companies are going to appeal more and more to the young and the healthy. Because if you're young and healthy, Blue Cross is going to charge you $100. You know, say your expected cost is 50 cents. You know, the sicker person's expected cost is $1.50. So the average is $1. Blue Cross has to charge you $1. Well, if you're young and healthy, you know that if you go to the commercial insurance plan, they're only going to charge you 50 cents. What that means, though, is that what's now left, so the low-cost people are going to leave Blue Cross and sign up with the commercial plans, which means that the Blue Crosses are going to become increasingly filled with higher-risk, sicker and sicker patients, more expensive patients, become lesser and less less and less attractive to the healthy and young, and a cycle begins that makes it very tough for the Blue Crosses to survive, which is why eventually the Blue Crosses of the world had to abandon community rating, at least in, to the extent they could get away with it legally. Yeah.
When you say that Blue Cross was, had to accept everyone,
right?
How did they deal with segregation? Was it truly open to everyone, or did they, certain hospitals wouldn't allow people of color into?
Absolutely. I mean, the hospitals were segregated throughout the South. And that was a huge issue. I mean, that's absolutely, that's, I don't know if everybody could hear. The question was, how did this all work in terms of the South, where most of the hospitals were segregated? And the answer there was, first of all, most of the Southern hospitals did not belong to Blue Cross plans. Blue Cross was much more of a Northern, Western phenomena, and less of a Deep South phenomena. And second of all, segregated hospitals in particular did not join Blue Cross plans. It wasn't until, and we'll talk about this later, it wasn't until Medicare was enacted in 1965 that segregation in the Southern hospitals really ended. So we'll come back to that story when we get to Medicare. All right, I want to, yeah. Right. In effect, it was more like a prepaid service plan. Right. Absolutely. Yep. That's absolutely right. All right. So I now want to switch gears a little bit. So on the one hand, we have this trend forming of Blue Cross and commercial insurance company increasingly marketing and appealing to sort of middle class and working class and upper class folks to join these new kinds of quote-unquote private health insurance plans. Question then begins to arise, what role, if any, should government play in this emerging health insurance world? Now let me just backtrack for a minute and talk about what was going on a little bit anyway. We'll come back to this much more in a few weeks, but a little bit what was going on in some other countries around the world. Back in the 1880s, in 1883, Germany had enacted a program under which all employers, all workers, well, all employers were required to have health insurance through their employer. It wasn't universal national health insurance for everybody in the country, but everybody who worked, everybody who had a job was required to have health insurance paid for by their employer. Now, the reason Germany had that system was Bismarck, the leader of the country in the 1880s, was very worried about the socialists taking over, very worried about the socialist movement in Germany. And so in an effort to preempt and undermine the socialist challenge, which was gaining great favor among the working class population in Germany, Bismarck said, all right, I'm going to provide workers with universal insurance. About 20 years later in Great Britain, 1911 in Great Britain, all industrial workers were guaranteed health insurance through their employer. These programs, both in Germany and Great Britain and in other countries around the world, started out simply as what you might call workers' compensation programs. I mean, they started out as programs in which if you got injured on the job, you were entitled to some compensation to take care of your lost income while you were out of work. But they moved from that workers' compensation model to an insurance model, health insurance model, where not only would you get compensation for your lost income, but you would have your medical bills paid for. So in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was a movement among industrial countries to provide health insurance, particularly for industrial workers. And remember, we had the Industrial Revolution, we had urbanization. Around the world, there was more and more manufacturing, more and more industry. And what a number of countries around the world were saying was, we want to make sure that workers have health insurance and can get back to work as soon as possible, and it's going to be up to the boss, up to the employer, to provide that health insurance. Here in the United States, here in the United States, around the same time that Great Britain adopts this plan, we in the United States are in the midst of what's known as the Progressive Era, in which Teddy Roosevelt and a whole host of other political leaders were leading an effort to bring some progressive reforms to the United States. Those progressive reforms included a range of efforts to clean up business, to make working conditions better, you know, for workers who were required to work, you know, 18 hours a day in sort of factories that were unsafe. So there are efforts to make working conditions safer. There were efforts to bring about, as in Europe and other places, worker compensation programs. So here in the United States, the progressives got states around the country to pass legislation saying that if you were injured while on the job, you would get some reimbursement for lost income. Progressives also tried to clean up corruption in the political environment. They tried to push for direct primaries and civil service. And there were all sorts of things that the progressives tried to do. And on the progressive agenda in 1911, 1912, 1913, 1914, here in the United States, on the progressive agenda here in the United States, were efforts to mimic, to replicate what was going on in Germany and Britain and European countries, other European countries. Here in the United States, the progressives were saying, we ought to make the factory owner, we ought to make the railroad owner, we ought to make the manufacturer provide health insurance for his workers, for their workers. Those proposals were never enacted in the United States. They were not enacted for a number of reasons. Number one, they were not enacted because the business community was dead set against them. Labor unions were much weaker in the United States than they were in Europe, but even to the extent that the labor unions had some strength, and that was one of the period of time in American history when they had as much strength, about as much strength as they've ever had, but even during that period, the labor unions were very ambivalent about whether or not they thought universal insurance for workers was a good idea. Doctors were dead set against universal insurance during that period. Doctors were afraid that would bring government into the healthcare system, and that was the worst thing imaginable from the medical community's point of view. They didn't want government involved at all in the healthcare system. So the doctors were against it, labor was ambivalent, business was against it. And on top of it all, this idea of universal insurance for workers was painted as and was viewed as a German idea. And this was right before and then right during World War I. And so the notion of here in the United States adopting a health insurance program that had originated in Germany was impossible. It was politically impossible. There was a tremendous, tremendous amount of anti-German feeling in the country at that point. And so this all became, even though Bismarck had started universal insurance in Germany in an effort to keep the socialists out and to keep the communists out, this was viewed here in the United States as this sort of socialist plot, this government plot, and the progressives just lost hands down in their efforts to get universal workers insurance in the United States. And then World War I comes around, and at that point, the thing's just dead in the water. And the progressive movement pretty much dies after that anyway, here in the United States. I fast forward a decade now to bring us back to what we were talking about earlier, the economic depression here in the United States. Stock market crashes in 1929. Depression becomes massive here in the United States. Huge unemployment. Banks closing by the thousands, farmers unable to make money. I mean, you all know and you've all seen many stories about the consequences of the economic depression. Herbert Hoover is the president of the United States at that point. And there are those who say to Hoover, you know what, the federal government ought to do something to deal with the consequences of this economic depression. The federal government ought to do something to try to scale back the causes of the economic depression and to solve some of the dilemmas created by the economic depression. The federal government ought to try to provide jobs to people. It ought to try to provide income security. It ought to try to provide security. But Hoover, and here you have to remember, Hoover was not alone. Hoover, much like the previous presidents for the previous 130 years, Hoover thinks not only would it be illegal, but it would be immoral and unconstitutional for the federal government to get involved in trying to regulate the economy. Hoover believes it is up to the states and local governments, and it is up to the business community and private markets to deal with the consequences of the economic, or to deal with both the causes and the consequences of the economic depression. And in fact, from a legal perspective, Hoover had some grounds to be nervous about the legality, at least, of the federal government getting involved. Because, and we'll come back to this in a few minutes, when the progressives during the 1910s and 1920s, well, particularly the 1910s, the progressives in a number of states had passed a whole host of laws, minimum wage laws, maximum hour laws, worker condition laws, all these laws designed to protect the workers here in the United States. And the United States Supreme Court, in many cases and with great regularity, had struck down those laws as being unconstitutional, saying that the states at that point, even the states, were barred from trying to regulate the relationship between the worker and the owner. That was a contract relationship that was entered into between the employee and the employer, and government had no right to try to regulate it whatsoever. That government had no right to try to regulate the economy. That was extra constitutional, that was outside the scope of the Constitution. And interestingly, sadly, ironically, what the Supreme Court used to strike down those laws in the 1910s, and to strike down those progressive era legislation, what the law they used was the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was basically the amendment that was provided, that was one of the so-called Civil War amendments that had been put in place. I mean, after the Civil War ends, there are three amendments added. One, basically, the 13th Amendment basically abolishes slavery. The 15th Amendment basically guarantees the right to vote. The 14th Amendment says that no state shall deprive anybody of due process of law. No state shall deprive anybody of the equal protection of the laws. That was an amendment that was designed to protect the newly freed slaves. In 1896, in Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court held that segregation was allowable under the 14th Amendment, separate but equal was allowable under the 14th Amendment, and the 14th Amendment did not prevent states from having two completely separate school systems, restaurant systems, water fountains, whatever it was. So the 14th Amendment was interpreted by the Supreme Court in the late 1800s to allow segregation to continue. 10 years later, that same 14th Amendment, which had been enacted as a amendment designed to protect the newly freed slaves, that same amendment was used by the Supreme Court to basically strike down progressive era legislation. Because the 14th Amendment says that nobody can be deprived of due process. What the 14th Amendment says is you can't deprive anybody of life, liberty, or happiness, in effect, without due process of law. And what the Supreme Court does is they include in the definition of liberty the right to contract between employer and employee. And so they hold that these progressive era laws violate the liberty component of the 14th Amendment. So it's pretty ironic and pretty sad, but what the court does is they use the 14th Amendment to strike down progressive era legislation, again, even though they had not used it to strike down segregation. So Roosevelt says to himself, Franklin Roosevelt now enters the scene. Franklin Roosevelt, governor of New York, wants to run for president against Herbert Hoover. Roosevelt knows that the Supreme Court has struck down lots of legislation regulating the economy just in the previous 10, 20 years. Roosevelt knows that there's an argument to be made that neither the states nor the federal government have a right to regulate the economy, have a right to regulate the relationship between the worker and the business owner. But Roosevelt is also convinced, is absolutely convinced, that Hoover is dead wrong to think that the economic depression will end simply by state action or market action. Roosevelt is convinced that in 1935, 1932, 33, 34, America and in the world, you need a strong federal government to deal with America's economy. You need a strong federal government fueled by a powerful president to deal with the consequences of the Depression, to get the country back on its feet again, to get people working again, to get the banks working again. Roosevelt's convinced we need to change fundamentally the way American government has worked and is working. Roosevelt echoes Alexander Hamilton from 130 years earlier. Remember, Hamilton had said, America will only work if we have a strong federal government fueled by a powerful presidency. Jefferson had said, no, we want localism, we want states' rights, we want sort of small-town democracy. We don't want the federal government, we don't even want the states getting involved in the economy. That's not their role, that's not their place. That Jeffersonian vision had dominated from 1800 through the Hoover era. Roosevelt says to himself, we have to change that vision. Roosevelt goes to the Democratic National Convention in 1932 and accepts the nomination for president. And during his acceptance speech, Roosevelt says the following. He says, yes, when, not if, when we get the chance, the federal government will assume bold leadership in distress relief. That was unheard of in American history at that point. For years, Washington has alternated between putting its head in the sand and saying there is no large number of destitute people in our midst who need food and clothing, and then saying the states should take care of them, if there are. Instead of planning 2.5 years ago to do what they're now trying to do and should do, they kept putting it off from day to day, week to week, month to month. I say, while the primary responsibility for relief rests with localities, now as ever, so that's Roosevelt saying, I understand we have 150-year history, primary responsibility rests with localities, the federal government always had and still has a continuing responsibility for the broader public welfare. It will soon fulfill that responsibility. And then Roosevelt says, and among his most famous line, I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people. What Roosevelt was calling for when he called for a new deal was a new social contract, a new set of relationships between the citizens and the government, the federal government. A new relationship in which the federal government would have significantly more power than it had in the previous 150 years. Revolutionary ideas, but ideas that Roosevelt was able to articulate largely because the country was in the midst of this huge economic depression and people were desperate for answers, were desperate for help. Roosevelt takes office, day to take office, and one day in March 1933. March 9th, 1933, Roosevelt took office. At that point, between 1929 and 1933, over 5,000 banks in the United States had closed. More than 35% of the workforce was unemployed. Unemployment rate was over 35%. Huge, huge economic problems. Roosevelt comes into office. Banks are closing every day. Another one's closing. People were desperate to get their money out of the bank because they thought the banks were going to go out of business. But of course, when all the people go to the bank and say, give me your money, the bank doesn't have the money because the banks invested the money in the stock market and the stock market's crashed. The first thing Roosevelt does on his first day in office, anybody know what Roosevelt does on his first day in office? Yeah. He declares a bank holiday. He shuts every bank in the country down. Nobody can go to the bank. Banks are closed for business. He then calls an emergency session of Congress. And a week later, 8 days later, he gets Congress to pass legislation regulating the banking industry. He then goes on the radio. At that point, the radio was the medium through which you can reach folks. It was the internet of the day or the TV of the day. Goes onto the radio and begins what he calls a series of fireside chats, conversations with the American people. And he says, you know what? I know it caused some hardship for some folks to close banks for the last week. You know, people couldn't get to their money. But we needed to satisfy ourselves that the banking industry would be secure and safe. We needed to stop the hemorrhaging. We need to pass legislation that regulates the banking industry. So I could tell you, American public, right now, with total confidence and total security, that you don't have to worry about your bank. You don't have to worry about the money you've deposited in the bank. It's not going to disappear. It's going to be secure. It's going to be safe. And little by little, we're going to start opening banks again around the country. But you don't have to run to the bank, try to pull the money out and put it under your pillow. You're much better off with your money in the bank than under your pillow. So Roosevelt calms the fears. The only, you know, the only thing you have to fear is fear itself and all that stuff. You know, you calms the American public's fear over the banking industry. He then begins 100 days of efforts, the sort of first 100 days, in which he says, you know, the first thing we have to do before we do anything else is we got to get people back to work. We got to get people jobs. We got to cut federal spending. We got to get farmers shored up and secure so they can operate their farms without losing their shirt. And it's the federal government that has to do this. Can't rely on the states, can't rely on the counties, can't rely on business, can't rely on the marketplace. It's the federal government that has to do this. So in a bang, bang, whirlwind tour of legislative activity, Roosevelt gets through, let me just give you the names of some of these programs. They'll sound familiar to you. You know, the Public Works Administration, the Federal Music Project, the Federal Theater Project, the Works Project Administration, the Rural Electrification Administration. All of these programs, again, designed to get people jobs, to get people working, to get the economy going, to use the federal government as the lever to get the government going. Brand new stuff in American history. Brand new. Roosevelt also says, you know what? It should be the federal government that provides income security for people and health security for people. Roosevelt wants three kinds of programs enacted around income security. Number one, he wants sort of a German or British style universal insurance program in which employers are required to provide health insurance for their employees. He thinks that's a good idea. His advisors think it's a good idea. Roosevelt also wants retirement insurance or retirement pensions for senior citizens who are suffering among the worst poverty rates in the United States. And Roosevelt also wants, the third thing he wants, is he wants cash assistance welfare for the so-called deserving poor who are out of the workforce through no fault of their own. And he wants the federal government basically to take the lead. But while Roosevelt wants all these things, even Roosevelt himself has tremendous, tremendous political opposition. Start with the universal insurance proposal. Or at least the notion, it wasn't universal insurance, but it was the notion of universal insurance for workers. The American Medical Association, the big business community, the labor community, the Republicans in Congress, the conservative Democrats in the Senate and the House, all were dead set against universal health insurance. And at that point, in 1934 and 1935, at that point, it's not a big enough issue for Roosevelt to say, you know what, I want to take on the AMA. Roosevelt was afraid if he took on the AMA over universal insurance, his entire effort to put in place a New Deal would be jeopardized. So Roosevelt drops his universal insurance proposal. But Roosevelt doesn't want to drop the other two ideas he had, retirement insurance and cash assistance for the deserving poor. But here, too, he has big problems. Who do you think his biggest opponents were of both of those efforts? Well, Republicans were clearly opposed. What section of the country in particular, though, and why? The South. And what do you think Southern congressmen, both Democrats and Republicans, were so worried about? Anybody? Yeah. Sorry. What the Southerners were worried about was that national welfare programs or national retirement programs or national unemployment programs could and would jeopardize the plantation economy. When the Civil War ended, the slaves were freed. But many of those same slaves ended up staying on the same plantation, only now they worked as quote-unquote tenant farmers, in which they worked the land. But basically, any money in theory they made was given back to the plantation owner to pay for rent and food and the other things that the plantation owner provided for the tenant farmer. The plantation economy relied on this physical labor, which was provided primarily by low-income blacks. Southern Democrats were afraid that if bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. started creating these new nationalized retirement programs, welfare programs, health programs, and the like, the entire Southern economy would and could fall apart. Roosevelt ends up agreeing to a series of compromises. And in 1935, Roosevelt and the Congress pass the Social Security Act. The Social Security Act creates what you could call the New Deal welfare program, New Deal welfare system. The New Deal welfare system has two main branches to it. The first branch, is it hot in this room? Well, yeah. Need some windows or something. I can't even take my jacket off because I have like microphones in every pocket. I'll have to break. The first branch of the New Deal welfare system provided a system of social insurance, old age insurance, retirement insurance, what we would today call Social Security. The idea was workers would pay into a trust fund a tax while they were working, and then when they retired, they would get a pension, and they would get that pension from the federal government. Some key things to remember about social insurance programs, the Social Security program. Number one, it is run by and administered by the federal government. It is a federal program run in a relatively uniform way around the country. Number two, it has always been a relatively popular program because people feel as if they're paying in and they're getting back. They feel as if it's an earned right. It's a pension. It's not welfare. It's not charity. They're paying for the benefit they get. And it's available to every worker, at least today. It wasn't back then, but at least today. So people feel like they're paying in, they're getting back, they're earning their benefits. It's uniformly run. It's run by the federal government in a relatively comprehensive, clear, focused manner. Now, in order to get Social Security, Roosevelt had to make some he wanted the federal government to run it, just like he wanted the federal government to run all these programs. And he won on Social Security. Although the Southerners, what they were able to get, Southern Democrats and conservatives were able to get, was originally excluded from the Social Security system with different classes of workers, including farm laborers and domestic workers. They were excluded from Social Security. So what that meant was that over 90% of the blacks in the South were excluded from the Social Security system when it was enacted. Now, the law did not say blacks can't get Social Security, but the law said that farm laborers can't get Social Security. And, of course, there were whites who lost out as well from that. But the intent and the purpose and the outcome was that the largest impact was on the African-American community in the South. And that wasn't changed until the early 1950s. But what Roosevelt did get in place with Social Security was a system in which you had a relatively insulated federal agency in Washington, D.C., making decisions in a relatively uniform way around the country for a pretty popular program. And Social Security today, in 2006, is still a pretty popular program. It's still run in a pretty uniform way around the country. And while Americans, many Americans, particularly younger Americans, are concerned about the viability, the viability of Social Security long term because of changing demographics and the like, as we all know, when President Bush last year gave his State of the Union address, which again he'll be giving the next version of tomorrow night, but when he gave his version last year, changing fundamentally Social Security was at the top of his agenda. He failed miserably over the last year in that effort. I mean, Social Security is a very, still to this day, very popular, very difficult program to amend, to change. And part of the reason it's so popular is because, as I said, the feds run it in a uniform way and people feel like they've earned an entitlement to it. Now, you contrast that with the other wing of the New Deal social welfare program, which was aid to families with dependent children or cash assistance welfare for the deserving poor. AFDC, unlike Social Security, AFDC was administered by the states. The states got to decide who was eligible for benefits, and the states got to decide the extent of those benefits. There was, as a result, not surprisingly, tremendous variation between the states and among the states in AFDC eligibility policy, AFDC benefit policy, and the like. So the Southern Democrats basically were able to preserve the plantation economy by preserving control over the welfare system and by excluding blacks from retirement programs like Social Security. So the Southern Democrats won some significant victories back then. But at the same time, while the Southern Democrats won some victories, Roosevelt also won a huge victory in that the Social Security Act, both wings of it, Social Security plus AFDC, represented the first time in American history that the Congress of the United States had passed massive social welfare legislation of this sort. The only previous examples, really the only previous example, of a federal income security program prior to Social Security were pension programs given to Civil War and even Revolutionary War veterans. But other than some pensions to vets, the federal government had never come close to doing anything like this before. It had never come close to doing anything like this before. So this was a major moment in the social welfare system in the United States. Any questions on this so far? Yeah. Looking for federal what?
Decrease in spending.
Right.
It just seems kind of off there.
Right. What he was trying to do was cut the initial federal budget to sort of cut the federal budget. And so what he did initially in those first 100 days before he... See, Roosevelt had sort of two different kinds of plans. One kind of plan was sort of immediate short-term stopgap measures. And there he needed to cut some federal spending. So, for example, what he did was he cut veterans' benefits by 50% within the first couple of weeks he was in office. He cut some bureaucracy. He cut some jobs. But then, you're absolutely right, he wanted to more long-term and more systematically, dramatically build up the scope of the federal government. So much so that the federal share of the gross domestic product, which was about 2-3% when Roosevelt took office, was double figures within just a few years. So you're absolutely right. But he wanted to raise that money, for example, Social Security, through taxes. You know, he didn't want, you know, what he wanted to do was sort of cut the budget deficit, but then start raising money through federal taxes and otherwise to create these new federal programs. Any other questions? Well, you all faint. All right. Roosevelt was right to worry about the courts. Remember I mentioned during the Progressive Era, the courts had struck down a number of Progressive Era laws as being unwarranted intrusions into the contractual relationship between the worker and the owner. So Roosevelt was right to worry about that, and in fact, in 1936, and then in 1937, the United States Supreme Court, by 5-4 votes, close votes, by 5-4 votes, struck down as unconstitutional key provisions of the New Deal. The United States Supreme Court began to argue that Roosevelt and the New Deal architects were exceeding their authority under the Constitution. Yeah. Well, you're sort of jumping ahead. So then the question is, and then I'll turn right back to you. So Roosevelt now is in a situation in which the Supreme Court has started to strike down some key elements of his New Deal legislation. So Roosevelt responds by, what does he propose? Well, the comment, okay. Well, you're exactly right. What? Yeah. Right. What Roosevelt says is, you know what? There's a bunch of these 9 old guys on the court who are just, you know, they're trying to prevent the federal government from rescuing the country. They're trying to prevent the president from rescuing the country. Here I am. Here we are in the midst of an economic depression. Here we are, you know, 35% unemployment, banks in trouble, the economy in trouble, the world in trouble, and I'm coming up with all these great ideas, and here's the United States Supreme Court saying sorry. And who's on the Supreme Court? It's these nine guys, six of whom are over the age of 70. And you have to remember, back in 1935-36, you know, the average lifespan wasn't all that long. So, you know, these guys are getting on the Supreme Court and they're just staying there. And Roosevelt is very upset by this. So he proposes, and there's nowhere, if you pull out your Constitution, the Constitution does not say there shall be nine members on the Supreme Court. The Constitution says there shall be a number of folks on the Supreme Court, and that number shall be set by Congress. And so Roosevelt goes to Congress and he says, you know what? What we ought to do is we ought to increase the number of members of the Supreme Court from 9 to 15. What we ought to do is for everybody over the age of 70 on the Supreme Court, we ought to have a new judge. And of course, what that would mean, when Roosevelt would get to appoint six new judges, presumably all of whom would agree with him. And that would be the end of the constitutional crisis. Now, here Roosevelt begins to get himself in political trouble. Because this idea, the idea of packing the court, quote-unquote, adding six members to the Supreme Court, does not strike the American public as a good idea. You can only imagine, if Roosevelt is able to, you know, get Congress to add six members to the Supreme Court in 1937... what happens when Dwight Eisenhower becomes president in the 1950s? I mean, Truman will say, all right, he'll go along with the Roosevelt 15. Eisenhower then comes in, and he doesn't like the Supreme Court, and he goes to Congress and gets another 5 or 10. You know, Kennedy comes in, gets more. Nixon comes in, gets more. By the time you got to Clinton and Bush, you have a 40 or 50-person Supreme Court. And in effect, the Supreme Court would be even more of a political institution than it is today, because Congress would simply be changing the number on the Supreme Court to adopt to the political realities of the day. And that strikes many of the American public as to be a real attack on the notion of separation of powers. And so Roosevelt really, for the first time, starts getting into some political trouble at this point. Roosevelt also asks Congress to dramatically expand the size of the White House staff. Now, today, we're very used to White House, you know, presidents having huge staffs. Everybody from speechwriters to, you know, I'm not even talking about cabinet members, to, you know, the executive branch, chief of staff, and so on and so forth, a huge White House staff. That did not exist prior to Roosevelt. Roosevelt wants money for a big White House staff, basically to do all, you know, to help run and to help create all these new federal programs. That doesn't strike a lot of folks in the American public as a particularly good idea. Roosevelt also begins what he calls a purge campaign to try to purge the Democratic Party of folks who disagreed with him. So he actually begins supporting, in Democratic primaries around the country, candidates who are running against Democrats who disagreed with him. And that doesn't strike many in the Democratic Party as a particularly good idea. So Roosevelt begins to run into some political problems. Now, the court problem, who knows how the court problem gets solved? Who remembers that from the course? I mean, I can't overemphasize the political controversy that begins to swell around the effort to pack the court in 1937. And ultimately what happens is one member of the Supreme Court, remember Roosevelt was losing these cases 5-4. One member of the Supreme Court, a guy named Owen Roberts, decides to change his vote. And so instead of losing cases 5-4, Roosevelt begins to win cases 5-4. At that point, Roosevelt says, You know that court packing idea? We don't have to worry about that. At that point, the Supreme Court basically, for the first time in American history, says that the federal government has the right, the Congress has the right, to use the Interstate Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution as the grounds for regulating the economy, the national economy, in a host of ways. The Social Security Act, constitutional. Public Works Programs, constitutional. All these programs, constitutional. For the next 60 years, there is no question that Congress can do pretty much whatever it wants when it comes to the economy. The court will not interfere. It's not until the mid-late 1990s that for the first time since the New Deal, the United States Supreme Court begins to say to Congress, you know what, you're exceeding your power of the federal government. And that's part of the debate that we're in today, because it's really Justices Rehnquist and Scalia and Thomas and perhaps now Roberts, perhaps Alito, we don't know, who are beginning to say, we want to shift more power back to the states, the federal government has too much power, you know, Congress has too much power, states should have more power. And so there's this whole debate today in 2006 on the Supreme Court about the extent of congressional power. That's a debate that from the 1930s to the late 1990s we didn't have, because Roosevelt and the Roosevelt Court answered that debate seemingly definitively in the mid-1930s, although we're now learning it wasn't so, perhaps not so definitive after all. But, so Roosevelt backs off on the court thing, but it generates a lot of ill will towards him. And then some of his other ideas generate ill will toward him. So much so that in 1937, and I know you find this odd when you hear it, but Roosevelt actually releases a statement. There's hundreds of thousands of telegraphs that are sent in on a regular basis to Congress claiming that Roosevelt is now trying to become a dictator. He's trying to take over the country. Because then you can't overestimate, we went from 150 years from presidents who were basically weak. You know, I mean, obviously Abraham Lincoln was a strong president and there was the Civil War and the preserving of the Union, but were weak in the sense of making no effort to really engage in public policy making, social welfare policy making, healthcare policy making and the like, to Franklin Roosevelt, who basically wants the federal government, and not just the federal government, he wants him as president to make all these decisions. And so early on, Roosevelt was hugely popular because he seemed to be rescuing the country. But by the late 30s, there's a backlash against Roosevelt. And Roosevelt actually has to release a statement, a presidential statement, in which, among other things, he says, I have no inclinations to be a dictator. I have none of the qualifications that would make me a successful dictator, and I have too much historical background to make me desire any form of dictatorship in the United States. I mean, he has to respond in a serious way to claims that he's trying to become a dictator. Now, shortly thereafter, Pearl Harbor, World War II, the country is plunged into war, and at that point, Roosevelt again sort of takes on the mantle of sort of the national savior. And his popularity through the war goes back up again through the roof, as wartime presidents often find to be the case, at least early on in wars. You know, but so Roosevelt, sort of World War II, in a certain sense, almost rescues him politically. But at the end of the day, Roosevelt begins to say, you know what? I was too timid in 1935. I didn't take enough chances in 1935. And Roosevelt, toward the end of his life, in 1944 and in 1945, Roosevelt begins to call for what he calls a second Bill of Rights. A second Bill of Rights. And what Roosevelt says is that the first Bill of Rights sets forth those rights Americans have to be free from government regulation. They have a right to free speech. They have a right to freedom of religion. They have a right, all the things that you have a right to do as an individual. Roosevelt begins to say, we need a second Bill of Rights, because in order to exercise that first Bill of Rights, in order to exercise your right to freedom of speech, in order to exercise your right to freedom of thought, to freedom of expression, you can't be hungry. You can't be sick. You need a place to live. Those are prerequisites to truly exercising your fundamental Bill of Rights rights. And so Roosevelt says we need guaranteed housing. We need national health insurance. We need to provide you with the basics so that you can exercise your individual rights. Roosevelt says those things in 1944 or 1945, but they end up going nowhere politically. And in 1945, he dies. And Harry Truman becomes president. So let's take a short break, and then we'll come back and pick up the story with Harry Truman. Okie doke, we're going to start back up now. Wait. Oh, this is all working right. All right, Harry Truman becomes president in 1945. And Truman picks up the mantle that Roosevelt had left behind. And Truman, like Roosevelt toward the very end, becomes a strong advocate of national health insurance. Truman thinks that national health insurance should be part of what he calls a fair deal between citizens and government. Remember, Roosevelt had the New Deal, Truman has the fair deal. Truman proposes national health insurance in 1945. He proposes it in 1946, in 1947, 1948. Year after year, Truman, along with John Dingell and Wagner and some others in Congress, say we ought to have national health insurance here in the United States. There's two dynamics that take place in the 1940s, though, that keep national health insurance from being enacted. Dynamic number one is as in the 1915, 16, 14 era, as in that era, the doctors are dead set against it, the business community is dead set against it, the conservative Republicans are dead set against it, the conservative Democrats are dead set against it, labor is against it. So there's a lot of interest group opposition. But the other dynamic, and in fact that interest group opposition is vehement in suggesting that this is all a big plot, socialist plot to have government take over the country. But in addition to the clear interest group opposition, there's something else that's going on in the 1940s. And now we have to sort of bring back into the story Blue Cross and the commercial health insurers. Because in the 1940s, we have a pivotal moment, a key moment in the evolution of the American health insurance system. In the 1940s, we have a debate over whether or not government, as in Britain and other European countries, government ought to take the lead in guaranteeing health insurance for all Americans, or alternatively, whether or not the role of government should be to encourage the growth of the private health insurance market that's beginning to emerge via Blue Cross and the commercial insurers. And in light of all of this strong and powerful both cultural and interest group opposition to government administration and government financing and government oversight in a clear, explicit way of universal insurance. The United States decides in the 1940s in a number of ways that what government is going to do is simply encourage the growth of private insurance. Not require it, but encourage the growth of private insurance rather than mandating the creation of universal insurance. And so how does government encourage the growth of private insurance? Well, number one, the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, says that when a business provides health insurance to its employee, it can deduct the cost of that as a business expense. And the employee does not have to count the value of that health insurance as income. So the tax system is used in the 1940s and 1950s in a significant and serious way to encourage employers to provide health insurance to their employees. Number two, during World War II, the country implements a freeze on wage and prices. Economic national freeze, wage and price controls. However, Congress says that fringe benefits like health insurance will be exempt, largely exempt from the freeze. So unlike the Depression era, when you had 35% unemployment, by World War II, by the early 1940s, the economy is booming. We have a wartime economy. The economy is booming. We've got soldiers across the world. And the question isn't, you know, how do we get jobs for people? The question is, how do we fill jobs? Because we have a greater need for employees than we have actual jobs. And so employers begin to use fringe benefits like health insurance. Since they can't raise wages because there's a wage and price freeze, they use benefits like health insurance to lure workers. And number three, the National Labor Relations Board, which regulates relationships between unions and employers, the NLRB says that unions can negotiate for health insurance, which had not been clear previously. So these various governmental activities around the tax system, around wages, around union activity are all clear efforts on the part of government to encourage employers to provide health insurance for their employees. And this is brand new. Prior to this, when Blue Cross and commercial insurance companies were first starting out, when Justin Kimball and Baylor first started in 1929, those teachers paid that 50 cents out of their own pocket. You know, the city of Dallas didn't pay that 50 cents. Those teachers paid that 50 cents. When Justin Kimball went to the Republic National Bank and the Dallas Morning News and said, sign up with my plan, my prepaid service plan, the Dallas Morning News didn't pay that 50 cents. The newsmen paid the 50 cents. Through the 1930s and through much of the early 1940s, there was Blue Cross and there was commercial insurance, but people were paying the premiums out of their own pocket. As government begins to encourage the growth of the private insurance market and to encourage employers to provide health insurance for their employees, now for the first time in a significant and large way, the employer begins to provide the payment for the health insurance on behalf of the employee. And that is a fundamental change, and that ratchets way up the number of people with health insurance in the United States. So that employer-sponsored private health insurance becomes the norm for the majority of working Americans. Becomes the norm. The employer-sponsored private health insurance becomes the norm. So government, during the 1940s, it's kind of like, you know, what's the Robert Frost poem, you know, Two Roads Diverge or whatever it is. Well, here, in the 1940s, the two roads are sort of follow sort of a British or European model of government-sponsored national health insurance, or use the levers of government, tax and otherwise, to encourage growth in the private market, the private insurance system. And we choose the latter. We choose private insurance, tax incentives, and the like, and we create, or we incentivize the private sector and the employer community, and we develop in this country a norm in which employers provide health insurance as a perk, as a pension, as a benefit of the job. And so that becomes a pivotal moment. So that allows, that path allows, you know, the business community and the doctors and the Republicans and the conservatives to say, you know what, we don't need national health insurance in the United States. Why don't we need national health insurance? Because we've got this growing, emerging private insurance system. So that for most Americans, private insurance is the answer, and government's role, if any, should be as a safety net. As a safety net for those outside the workplace. So Truman's proposals for national health insurance go nowhere. At that point, Truman changes gears and says, you know what? If I can't get national health insurance, because now I'm putting words in Truman's mouth. If I can't get national health insurance. Truman Chinskin says, what I want to do is try to get a more incremental expansion. And what Truman proposes in 1949 is to expand the Social Security program, which Roosevelt had enacted in 1935, he says, let's expand Social Security so that we could provide hospital insurance for the elderly. Now, why do you think Truman proposes hospital insurance for the elderly? Why the elderly? They're not working. They're a popular group. They have great need that's not being met. They're not being helped by the private insurance system. You know, they're it seems like the perfect group to focus on if the core is going to be private insurance for the workers. Let's start with the elderly through a government program. And why hospitals? Why hospital insurance? Because the hospital was the place where healthcare was being delivered in the 1940s. The hospital was the place with the highest costs. The hospital was the place where the elderly in particular were getting care. And so the thought was, let's have a system in which all working people kick in some money, just as they do to Social Security, and then when they retire, they'll get hospital insurance to go along with their Social Security. So Truman proposes that in 1949. The Republicans object and oppose Truman's proposal for hospital insurance for the elderly. The Republicans argue... Do you have a question? No, sorry, okay. The Republicans argue, in effect, why should we give hospital insurance to all of the elderly? Why should we give hospital insurance to Nelson Rockefeller's mother and grandmother? You know, why should rich people have government-funded health insurance? If the role of government is to be a safety net, shouldn't we be focusing just on the poor, just on the indigent? In 1950, Congress passes an amendment to the Social Security Act. And under that amendment, Congress gives some money to the states, or it makes money available to the states, for the states to use to provide health care to people on welfare, on cash assistance welfare, the deserving poor. Basically, this model, this welfare medicine model, fits with the Republican agenda. Why? Because it's delegating, number one, to the states the responsibility to administer the program. It's focusing just on poor people. It's focusing just on the so-called deserving poor. And it's providing the safety net that the Republicans think makes sense. So That's passed by Congress. So you say, why did the Democrats go along? Why did Truman go along? Well, they went along because they didn't have the votes to get hospital insurance for all of the elderly. And so they thought they were better off getting something incremental passed, which would at least give some money to the states to help some poor people. So that became the first welfare medicine compromise. Throughout the 1950s, mainstream Democrats, from Truman to Adlai Stevenson to John Kennedy to Lyndon Johnson, consistently argue and push and advocate and propose hospital insurance for the elderly. Throughout that same period, the Republicans respond over and over again, whether it's John Dewey running against Truman, whether it's Dwight Eisenhower, or whether it's Richard Nixon. They respond over and over again by saying, we don't want hospital insurance for all of the elderly. What we want is some welfare medicine for poor people. And that becomes the debate through the 50s and early 60s. 1959, John Kennedy is running for president. He proposes hospital insurance for the elderly. He becomes president. He proposes hospital insurance for the elderly. He goes to Congress. He proposes hospital insurance for the elderly. The Republicans respond, we don't want hospital insurance for all of the elderly. And in 1960, Congress passes a law which basically says that Congress will give some additional money to the states, and the states will use that money to provide health care to the indigent elderly who are not on welfare. So the 1950 law gave the states money to provide health care to people on welfare. The 1960 law gives the states money to provide health care to low-income indigent elderly who are not on welfare. 1961, Kennedy proposes hospital insurance for all of the elderly. 1962, again, another welfare medicine compromise. This time, Congress gives some money to the states to provide health care to the indigent young disabled. So again, this constant back and forth. 1963, Kennedy proposes hospital insurance for all of the elderly. November of 1963, Kennedy is assassinated. Lyndon Johnson becomes president. Lyndon Johnson is elected, you know, in a massive victory in 1964 over Barry Goldwater. Early 1965, Lyndon Johnson proposes hospital insurance for the elderly. The same proposal. During this debate, I'm going to read you a couple of quotes just to show you the sort of two different sides, and I think we'll even hear one of them. I'm going to also show you a video in a couple of minutes. But during this debate in 1962, a very popular radio figure goes on the air in opposition to Kennedy's proposal for hospital insurance for the elderly. And he says the following. He says, write those letters now. Call your friends and tell them to write them. If you don't, this program, meaning hospital insurance for all the elderly, this program will pass just as surely as the sun will come up tomorrow. And behind it will come other federal programs that will invade every area of freedom as we have known in this country. Until one day, we will awake to find that we have socialism. And if you don't do this, and I don't do it, one of these days you and I are going to spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was like in America when men were free. So who knows who this was? You could probably guess. Somebody could probably guess. This was Ronald Reagan in 1962 on the air. At the same time, there were folks who were urging Lyndon Johnson to be much bolder, to be much bolder. There's an economist at Harvard named Rashi Fine, who's still around, just wrote a book this past year on sort of the medical mess that we're in right now. And Rashi Fine was on the group of advisors that were advising Lyndon Johnson as to how to proceed, you know, in 1964 and 1965 in the health insurance arena. And the advisors were basically advising Johnson just to go for the same old hospital insurance for the elderly. So I was sitting with Rashi Fine one day at a conference, and I was just chatting with him. And he said, you know, I was one of those advisors. I was saying we should be much bolder. I was saying, and there were a lot of us who were saying we should be much bolder and go for national health insurance. He goes, I'll send you the report. You know, so I said, all right. So like 2 days later, and you know, he sends me this thing in the mail with the report from this committee. And there's a sort of a comment at the end, you know, comments by Rashi Fine, in which, among other things, he says at the end, he says, I would therefore favor consideration of alternative national health programs financed in a non-regressive manner, providing universal insurance access for all Americans without the imposition of means tests. So basically, Fine and others were pushing those on this advisory committee to Johnson to be much bolder, but Johnson said no. Johnson said, I'm going to go with the same thing that Truman went for, that Kennedy went for, you know, that Stevenson went for. That's sort of the mainstream Democratic push, hospital insurance for the elderly. So by 1965, you've got the story where Johnson's proposing hospital insurance for the elderly. The AMA, the doctors, are saying, let's just do more welfare medicine. You know, let's give the states a little more money to give to the disabled or the indigent elderly. And then you have some Republicans in Congress who are saying, no, what we ought to do is a third thing. What we ought to do is a third thing, and that thing is really give the elderly physicians insurance. We shouldn't be encouraging them to go to the hospital all the time. We should be giving them an incentive to go see doctors out of the hospital. So you have these three proposals floating out there. Enter into the picture Wilbur Mills. Wilbur Mills was among the most influential political folks of the day. He was the chair of the Ways and Means Committee in Congress. Basically, nothing got through Congress without Wilbur Mills saying yes or no. Wilbur Mills hoped to be president one day. And every year I sort of ask, and I'm always amazed at how few people know what happened to Wilbur Mills. I bet, who knows what happens to one? We have one historian in the room. What happened to Wilbur Mills? Right, about a decade later, in 1974, Wilbur Mills was hoping to be president, but about a decade later, you're absolutely right, he ends up with the Argentinian stripper named Fanny Fox. And they have a big fight, and they end up in the Tidal Basin in Washington, D.C. One time I had actually in my class a guy who was driving by the Tidal Basin that night and saw all the police cars and sort of stopped, and there was Wilbur Mills and the stripper, basically none of them having any clothes on, and he was completely drunk and she was completely drunk, and that was the end of Mills's presidential ambitions. But before Wilbur met Fanny, or maybe he had met her at that point, but before Wilbur and Fanny got in trouble, Wilbur basically ran Congress to a large degree. And so Mills decides that the way he's going to sort of make a mark, is he's going to get Congress, he's going to take these three proposals that are on the table. Johnson's proposal for hospital insurance for the elderly, the Republicans' proposal for physicians insurance for the elderly, and the AMA proposal for welfare medicine, and he's going to combine all three into a piece of legislation with the help of some folks in the Johnson administration, as you'll see in a few minutes. And as a result, in 1965, the United States Congress passes Medicare Part A, which provides hospital insurance for the elderly. It passes Medicare Part B, which provides physician insurance for the elderly. And it passes Medicaid, which provides health insurance for low-income populations. The Medicare program builds right off of Social Security, in that people, and we'll talk about this in much more depth, but people basically pay into a trust fund, at least Medicare Part A, pay into a trust fund and then get the benefits when they retire. Medicaid follows the AFDC model, the welfare model, in that the states basically run the program and there's a lot of variation. But we'll talk about Medicare and Medicaid in much more depth. But first I want to show, there's a short, this past year, 2005, was the 40th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid. And the Kaiser Family Foundation put together a nice little about 10-minute video movie on sort of the history and the enactment of these two programs. So we're going to watch this right now. And can you hit the lights too? I'm not sure how to do that. The lights should be on here.
There was a time in America when the government had almost no role in providing health care.
You know the lights? We're trying to figure out the lights.
The elderly bartered, borrowed, or begged.
Wait, it's not showing.
Or they went without.
The technical problems.
Was medical care costs.
Wait, okay. Why don't you start from the beginning?
They could care, but it was that they could not afford it.
The elderly, even without the depression.
And I think we do have to cut the lights. Yeah.
Where are the lights?
Even without the depression, we're quite dependent.
Or if they went without. See a doctor. Or if they went without. The principal problem was medical care costs.
All right, just let it go from here. You have to be able to see the lights from here. Is there just a switch?
The principal problem was medical care costs. Not that people couldn't get good care, but it was that they could not afford it.
The elderly, even without the depression, were quite dependent on their sons and daughters. And the sons and daughters were out of jobs during the depression.
In 1930, life expectancy for white Americans was 61, for African Americans, just 48. Interest in national health insurance for every American, came and went in Washington. The debate became more serious in 1945 when Harry Truman became the first president to send a proposal to Congress.
Harry Truman was very much troubled during World War II when he found that there was no health care, and as a result, young men were coming in the army with lack in terms of their health, simply because there was no way of providing it.
Truman's effort failed, but the seed was planted. In 1960, Congress enacted the Kerr-Mills Bill. It provided federal funds to states for medically indigent seniors and passed with the support of Southern conservatives.
They thought it would help elderly people in the South. But what happened was that 3 years later, in 1963, only 32 states had adopted it. But of those states, five industrial states, in New York, California, Michigan, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania, got 90% of the dollars. And Mills was furious.
Congress has for
Mills is Chairman Wilbur Mills of Arkansas, whose House Ways and Means Committee was the gatekeeper to bolder legislation. Events converged to make that possible.
Paying a hospitalization.
Americans wanted to honor John Kennedy by enacting programs the slain president had supported. In the 64 election, Democrats seized control of Congress by a 2-to-1 margin over Republicans. And the needs of the elderly were escalating. We had just completed the 1963 Survey of the Ages. And what we had, and what we showed very clearly, was that only half the ages had coverage for health, and most of it was very, very poor coverage. Enter Lyndon Johnson, determined to drive through a health insurance program for everyone 65 and over. There was no plan yet to include younger, poor Americans.
Our older people are likely to be hospitalized 3 times as often as younger people. But their income is less than half that of people under 65.
When I came to the White House, the push was on that times are wasting. What have you done about this? What have you done about that? And Lyndon Johnson was always racing against time.
The debate over Medicare engaged the most powerful players of the time, the labor movement and the American Medical Association. For the AFL-CIO, Medicare would be a step toward something much bigger when the AMA and other opponents said this is just camel's nose under the tent. Yes, it was perceived that way by proponents as well, that once you could establish a really good program that was successfully working for all people over 65, then it might show that you could have a national program of health insurance for all. The AMA launched a massive campaign enlisting the help of a popular actor of the time, Ronald Reagan.
One of the most conventional methods that imposes statism or socialism on people is then by way of medicine. It's very easy to disguise a medical program as a humanitarian project.
The AMA's Dr. Edward Annis crisscrossed America, warning doctors of the socialist yoke Medicare bureaucrats would place around their necks.
They make the decisions and decide who gets in, who gets out, what they get, what they don't. Trying to interfere in practice medicine, and I predicted it would change, bring about a different system of medicine for all Americans.
The dilemma that AMA had was the problem was real. That was the single flaw in their opposition. But the problem was real and generalized. Whether the solution was the best solution, you could debate.
For Wilbur Mills, Medicare was a way to make good on the limited success of Kerr Mills, but he went even further. The administration's bill was straightforward, coverage of hospital bills. To encourage support from Republicans, Mills added the voluntary participation of doctors.
We were sort of all taken aback when the chairman said, well, everybody thinks doctors are going to be in Medicare, so we're going to put them in there. We all spoke to like this. We said, gee, we don't know how the hell we're going to pay doctors for this. So
Mills kept going. To placate the AMA, which did support health for 10 million Americans on welfare, he added a third element to the package, Medicaid. It would be financed the way Kerr Mills had been. Medicaid had virtually flown under the radar, and Mills was the pilot. Bob Ball and another administration official, Wilbur Cohen, witnessed the chairman make his move.
And one afternoon in this committee, in private session, when Wilbur and I were there, Mills said, well, why don't we do this? Like he just thought of it. Well, Wilbur and I were more or less open-mouthed.
The three-layer cake, as it was called, passed in the summer of 65. The old and the poorest Americans would have health insurance. Congressman John Dingell sat in a chair when votes were cast, a testament to his father, who was a congressman, fought for national health insurance.
Inside for me, there was a sense of quiet, elation, and happiness that we had done something important. Most people don't know the story. A lot of people think that, you know, this was always fair and good, it was easy.
And to honor the early footwork of President Truman, Johnson staged the signing ceremony in Truman's hometown of Independence, Missouri.
We wanted you to know, and we wanted the entire world to know, that we haven't forgotten who is the real daddy of Medicare.
For those in charge of implementing Medicare, the hard part was just beginning. The Social Security Administration needed to enroll 19 million elderly Americans in a matter of months, in a time before supercomputers.
The Social Security District offices were kept open until the evening for people who were still at work. The Forest Service even had rangers looking for hermits in the woods. Every agency of government was helping. I don't know whether this has ever been repeated again.
In 1 week alone during the campaign, a million people enrolled. President Johnson, meanwhile, had another concern, a potential boycott by doctors. He called AMA leaders to the White House, ostensibly to talk about supporting the Vietnam War. But when they went in front of the press, the subject changed.
Johnson says, call in the press. The press comes in, and the first question is about Medicare. The guy's going to sign up under Medicare, and Johnson says, these men, they're sending physicians over to Vietnam to die for this country. Of course they're going to support the law of the land and sign up for Medicare. Turns to the LMA president, says, doctor, and the president says, yes, of course we will.
Doctors were in, but would hospitals do the same? Would the nation's 1,000 segregated hospitals begin treating blacks and whites equally, a requirement to participate in Medicare?
It was a very worrisome period to think that you may have hundreds of hospitals that would not be available to patients. It didn't work out that way because the president was so adamant about his position that we would not give ground on that issue. And it made all the difference. I mean, it totally transformed medical care in the United States.
In the first week, just 7 calls of complaint came into a government hotline. The process of integration had begun at a time when about 4 out of 10 African Americans lived in poverty.
The combination of Medicare, Medicaid, and civil rights legislation changed the health care landscape forever. For black Americans and for all Americans, not just for those who were 65 and above.
Americans, especially the neediest Americans who never had medical care, were now getting it.
There were a lot of elderly people and low-income people in the case of the Medicaid program who were clearly, in many instances, receiving services for the first time, and many of whom had not had a surgical procedure they've been delaying or not had access to other kinds of care, so that you could tell that this program was making a difference in people's lives.
Before long, the programs were costing more than anyone expected. Some congressmen complained Medicaid was becoming a blank check for the welfare system. Doctors, reluctant players in the beginning, realized that treating elderly Medicare patients for their usual and customary fees was not a bad deal.
Our greatest miscalculation was that we thought more physicians would mean more competition and they'd lower their rates. And what we didn't realize was that everybody did act in accordance with their economic interests.
Despite those emerging concerns over spending, both Medicare and Medicaid have expanded over the years. Medicare now costs more than $300 billion a year. It serves 42 million Americans. More than 6 million are under age 65 and permanently disabled. They became eligible in 1972.
There was a strong desire to cover the disabled under the Medicare program, but the costs were huge of doing that. So the decision they made was to cover the disabled, but only after they had been disabled for 2 years. That dramatically cut the cost of adding the disabled because it was kind of a Darwinian cost-cutting reduction. Half of the disabled died before they reached the two-year period.
One exception to that two-year window was for people with end-stage renal disease, an 11-hour trade-off with a senator who had lost a bid to add drug coverage to Medicare.
It was thrown out in the conference of the House, and about an hour later, the kidney provision came up, and Senator Long looked at Chairman Mills and said, look, you didn't give me the drugs, you got to give me the kidneys. And after a little bit of love rolling, you know, was successful in that regard.
Still, many people long believed Medicare had gaping holes. In 2003, President Bush and the Republican-led Congress took the first step to fill one major hole by adding prescription drug coverage.
We're doing a lot of work now just to bring Medicare up to date for the people it was intended to cover, for the promise that we've made to seniors and people with disabilities. And keeping that promise is going to be pretty tough in the years ahead as we face the baby boom and as costs keep rising.
Medicaid has evolved over the years as well, from a program for welfare recipients only to a safety net for the nation's low income. In 1984, the link between Medicaid and welfare began to loosen. For the first time, states were required to cover some pregnant women and very young children from low-income families.
There are 25 million low-income children in the program now. They have eligibility for screening and diagnosis for their health care status.
And it's been an enormous benefit for these kids to have a healthy start, to have a real chance to live out their lives and realize their potential as human beings.
Today, Medicaid is under more cost pressure than ever, with President Bush and the governor engaged in a fiscal tug of war over how much to spend and who should pay. The program costs more than $300 billion a year and covers 52 million people, including 13 million disabled and elderly. Many live in nursing facilities or receive community-based long-term care services. As baby boomers age and need long-term care, costs will climb.
You can't continue on with Medicaid the way it is. I would put a bigger burden on the federal government for providing for long-term care. But I'd also put in incentives for keeping people in their homes longer instead of going through the institutions.
Despite the challenges to sustain the program, no one disagrees that Medicare and Medicaid have improved the lives of millions, that these programs help create a health care system that might not otherwise exist.
If it wasn't a Medicaid, I can't conceive of there being a nursing home industry. Sure, you'd have a high-end assisted living facilities for the wealthy, but you'd decimate the rest of the long-term care. Children's hospitals, I believe it's like 40% of their revenue coming from the Medicaid program. The key institutions in every major city in America would be in terrible shape.
A lot of care was given that would never have been given if it hadn't been for Medicare, particularly quality of life activities, for example, cataracts, hip replacements. It's important not just for the elderly. What it has done is to relieve the burden on the children of the elderly, whoever it was, being most likely to have had to pay for this.
It's also done a lot to stimulate and to finance the modernization of the healthcare system in the United States. I mean, you have hospitals that were reimbursed when they weren't being paid adequately before. They've modernized completely in the period of time from the passage of Medicare to now.
In 1965, after creation, President Johnson spoke about a nation that is not indifferent to despair. John Dingell, who presided over the House vote all those years ago, believes those words, that promise, have been met.
This was an attempt to scientifically address certain the best judge society by the way it treats its young, its old, its sick, the unfortunate. Those who have the least.
What I want to do now, first of all, any questions or comments on the movie or something that was said in the movie? Or any, yeah.
So other people that are on Medicaid, what are they getting from Medicaid?
Medicare provides some basic services to the elderly and to the disabled. And we're going to talk about Medicare in much greater depth in a week or so. If you're what's known as a dual eligible, in other words, you're over the age of 65 and you're poor, so you're on both programs, Medicare and Medicaid, then Medicaid fills in the gaps that Medicare doesn't cover. So, for example, long-term care or prescription drugs up until right now, or there's all sorts of things that are not covered by Medicare, which would be paid for by Medicaid. So Medicare would be the first payer for the elderly, and then things that Medicare doesn't cover, Medicaid would fill in the gaps for. Yeah. Right, on each of the programs. Right. Actually, it's, we're going to get into that in some depth. I mean, the large majority, if you look at the per capita spending, it's primarily the aged and the disabled that have the much higher per capita spending on Medicaid than do sort of young kids and
and moms. So there are different populations on the program. When it comes to administrative costs and management costs, both Medicaid and Medicare cost far less per capita than private insurance does. But we'll be going through that in some depth. I mean, really what's happened is Medicaid has become, you know, a safety net for the sickest, the hardest to treat, the most disabled populations in the country, and they're the most expensive populations in the country. Although if you look at the numbers, Medicare spends about $300 billion on 52 million. Spends about $300 billion on 52 million. Medicare spends about $300 billion on 42 million. So even among the two, Medicaid, even despite the fact that it has some of the sickest and the poorest, serves 10 million more people than Medicare for about the same amount of money. So, but we'll go through that in some depth. Yeah?
Can you explain a little bit, because I think I got a little confused from us going from like Wilbur Mills pushing three proposals and us getting Medicare A and Medicare B, and then going into Medicaid in the movie?
Okay, the three proposals that Mills pushed. One was hospital insurance for all of the elderly, and that became Medicare Part A. One was physician's insurance for the elderly, and that became Medicare Part B. And then the third was sort of the welfare medicine proposal that the AMA was pushing, and that became Medicaid. Yeah?
I noticed theoretically, the Medicare program sounds like really great. You can care about the elderly. And also Medicaid, like to take care of the elderly. But then you have a lot of abuse in the system where a lot of people, as they approach retirement age, will try to get rid of their assets so that they can qualify for Medicaid, and therefore, instead of they picking up most of their expenses that they pay, that
right.
The government steps in instead, and they can save whatever assets they have and pass it on to the
children. Right. The question for those in the back who couldn't hear is, and let me both preface it. Talk about it for 30 seconds and then say we're going to be talking about it a lot when we do long-term care in another session. But the question is, the premise is Medicaid now is by far the biggest payer. Medicaid is really the only main payer that we have, insurance payer that we have for nursing home care in the United States. Private insurance, employer-sponsored private insurance doesn't cover nursing home care, and there's not many people that have private long-term individual insurance. So Medicaid is basically the payer for nursing home care. It pays about half the nursing home bill in the United States. So the question is, isn't it the case that there's a lot of middle class folks who've worked their whole life, never been on welfare, never been on Medicaid, you know, have some money in the bank, who as they approach, you know, their latter years, as they're getting sicker, as they think they might end up in a nursing home, transfer a lot of their assets to their grandkids or whoever, so that when they go into a nursing home, can go on Medicaid right away. Instead of spending the $100,000 they have in the bank on nursing home care in the first year they're in the nursing home, they give that money to their grandkids, and they go into the nursing home, and on day one, Medicaid pays the bill. That question about transferring of assets is one of the most controversial questions about Medicaid today. There clearly is some of that goes on. How much of it that goes on is not clear at all. But at the top of the agenda, if you look at President Bush, I mean, if you watch President Bush tomorrow night when he's doing in the State of the Union address, if he talks about Medicaid cost containment, he's going to talk about transferring of assets. It's going to be one of the three things he's going to talk about. So the short answer to your question is, yes, it's a very big issue. We're going to spend a lot of more time talking about it. But it's not clear how big a problem it really is. Yeah.
What happened with the initial Darwinian strategy?
Well, I mean, there's lots. I mean, there's periods of time where people go without and don't get covered. I mean, there's still, you know, and that becomes around transferring of assets. That becomes a big issue also, because there's a lot of efforts to keep people from transferring assets, which ends up keeping people from getting Medicaid coverage, keeping them out of the nursing home. So all of those questions, as the battles over cost containment become clearer and efforts to cut costs become clearer, you'll see a lot of these same kind of issues play out over and over again. Yeah? The question was, why are physicians, were physicians so opposed to the program? And I think the answer is ideological and cultural. The physician community was convinced that government involvement would mean government regulation both of the practice of medicine and the financing of medicine. And, you know, most doctors were single solo practitioners, and the last thing in the world they wanted was government telling them anything about how to run their practice. So as an industry and as a culture, they just grew to despise the thought of government involvement in the healthcare system. Ironically, as was pointed out in the video, doctors and hospitals and providers soon learned that having government pay the bill, or a big chunk of the bill, wasn't so bad. And actually, you know, government was so anxious to keep doctors happy that it paid pretty generously, at least under Medicare. So there have been some changes over time on that, but I think it was sort of a cultural and ideological opposition initially. Okay, one more, yeah. Right. We're going to be talking. Absolutely. It's against government involvement in the. Right. Right. Absolutely. No, I agree. I agree. Okay, what I want to do is spend about 10, 15 minutes now, and then I'll let you go. I mean, I won't probably at about 10 after, so 10 after, quarter after. But I want to spend 10, 15 minutes beginning the discussion of Medicaid. What I'm going to do is start out talking about Medicaid. Then next week, the first half of the class, I'm going to finish Medicaid, and then I'm going to talk about Medicare. And so just go through both the history of the programs in a little more depth and some of the key issues on the agenda for both of those programs. As the video pointed out, there are about 52 million Americans on Medicaid these days, and it's a $300 billion program. So it's a big program, no question about it. Generally, the way the program works is the federal government says to the states, you, the state, come up with a program for health insurance for poor people in your state. And so long as that program meets some basic federal rules, we, the federal government, will kick in between 50 and 80% of the cost of the program. The poorer the state, the more the federal government will kick in. So in New York, for example, which on a per capita basis is a pretty wealthy state, the federal government pays 50% of the cost of the state's Medicaid program. In Alabama and Arkansas and Mississippi, some low-income states, really low-income states, the federal government pays 78, 79% of the cost of the program. The idea is low-income states need more federal help, and they need more federal assistance. The federal government basically says to the states, though, you decide how the program is going to work. Now, in my view, as I look at Medicaid, it seems to me Medicaid has gone through four separate eras. This is not on the video, this is not sort of in classic textbooks or whatever, this is just my sort of looking at the Medicaid program over the last 40 years. The first era went from the mid-60s, when the program was enacted, to the mid-80s. So for the first 20 years of the program, you had what I would call the first Medicaid era. And in the first Medicaid era, the federal government basically gave the states extraordinary discretion to run their programs pretty much however they wanted. The states got to decide who was eligible for Medicaid benefits. The states got to decide largely what benefits those beneficiaries received. The states got to decide largely the reimbursement policy under which providers would be paid. The states got to decide almost everything about the program. I mean, to be sure, the federal government said to the states, you have to cover everybody on AFDC, on welfare, cash assistance welfare, except the states decided who in their state was on welfare. To be sure, the federal government said, you know, there's about a dozen benefits that you have to cover in your Medicaid program. But there was another 30 benefits or so that the states could cover if they wanted to cover with federal participation. So as a result of this great discretion that the states had during that period from 65 to 85, 86, as a result of that great discretion, there was extraordinary variation in the 50 state Medicaid programs. You're only 55 if you count Washington, D.C. and some of the territories. No two state Medicaid programs looked alike, and no two state Medicaid programs look alike. No two state Medicaid programs have the same benefit package. No two state programs have the exact same eligibility rules. No two state programs use the same reimbursement tools. No two state programs have the same per capita costs and the same overall cost and control. I mean, I wrote in the mid-1990s, I wrote a book which tried to look at why it was that the New York State Medicaid program spent, and these numbers are a little off, I don't even remember the numbers, but at the time, say New York had at the time about 2 million beneficiaries and was spending, say, $10 billion. Say it had 2 million beneficiaries. These numbers might not be right, but just to illustrate a point. Say it had 2 million beneficiaries and was spending $10 billion. The California Medicaid program had about 4 million beneficiaries, where it had twice as many beneficiaries and was spending about $5 billion. So basically, California had twice as many beneficiaries and was spending about half as much money as New York. And so I did this whole research and investigation and wrote this book on sort of what explained why New York spent twice as much on half as many people. And again, extraordinary variation. I won't bore you with all the reasons, but extraordinary variation in Medicaid programs. And that variation sort of originated during that first 20-year period. In the mid-1980s, that dynamic changed. And the start of the change takes place in the South. In the South, with a new breed of Southern Democratic governor. Sort of the Bill Clintons and the William Winters and so on and so forth. And these new Democratic governors in the South had two key priorities. One was to reform the education system in the South, and two was to reduce the high levels of infant mortality in the South, particularly among the African American communities in the South. The governors in the South got together with advocates of the Children's Defense Fund and other places, and they decided what they wanted to do to attack high rates of infant mortality was increase Medicaid eligibility for pregnant women on the theory and on the thinking that if more pregnant women, low-income pregnant women, were made Medicaid eligible, they would have access to and would take advantage of and would receive greater amounts of prenatal care, and as a result of the greater prenatal care, the rates of infant mortality and low birth weight would decline. There was a problem, however. There was a problem. They simply couldn't say you've got a state like Alabama or Mississippi. Bill Winter was the governor of Mississippi. And at the time, Mississippi probably covered poor people up to, say, 30% of the poverty level, 25-30% of the poverty level in its Medicaid program. So you had to be below 25% of the poverty level to be eligible for Medicaid in Mississippi. That meant 75% of the women who were low-income pregnant women were not even eligible for Medicaid in Mississippi. What Winter wanted to do and what the Southern governors wanted to do was increase the eligibility for those pregnant women without increasing the eligibility for other kids and adults and everybody else. But there was a federal rule at the time which said if you increase eligibility for one group, you have to increase eligibility for every other group. You have to have the same eligibility levels for all groups. And so the Southern governors and the Children's Defense Fund went to Congress and they said, you know what, you should give us an exemption from this rule so that we can have expanded Medicaid coverage for pregnant women and infants in our community so that we can address the problem of infant mortality, we can address the problem of high rates of low birth weight, we can address the problem of high-cost infants, we can deal with those problems without bankrupting our state Medicaid program. And Congress said, sounds like a good idea. Sounds like a good idea. And so in 1986, Congress said to the states, you can, if you want, cover pregnant women and kids below the age of 5 up to 100% of the poverty level. Even if everybody else in your state is only eligible at 30% of the poverty level. You can have different rates, different eligibility rates for pregnant women and young kids than everybody else. That became an option for the states. And the governor said, great. And a number of states, particularly in the South, started expanding eligibility coverage for low-income pregnant women and for young kids. Enter into the picture Henry Waxman, congressman from California, who you saw on the video, whose guy, bald head, mustache, was talking at the end about the great things that Medicare and Medicaid have done for millions of Americans. Waxman was and is a liberal Democrat from California. Waxman, strong advocate for national health insurance. Waxman knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that national health insurance didn't have a prayer in 1986, 1987, 1988. Ronald Reagan was president, then George Bush was president. You know, the Democrats were sort of in shambles. You know, he knew that there was no chance of national health insurance. National health insurance. Waxman looks at this approach that the Southern Democrats have taken to get these options to expand Medicaid, and he says to himself, you know what? There's a backdoor way that we can actually look to move towards national health insurance in the United States. And that backdoor vehicle is to require, to mandate, to impose federally on the states the requirement that they expand their Medicaid eligibility rules. And so in 1988, Congress passes a law, and Waxman, I'm not going to even get into with you the parliamentary mechanisms through which he got this through Congress during a sort of Reagan-Bush administration. It's an interesting story, but beyond what we have time for here, particularly when you're all waiting for me to stop so you can go home. So Waxman gets Congress to pass a law in 1988 which requires the states to cover pregnant women and infants up to 100% of the poverty level. Now, you have to remember, nationally at that time, Medicaid covered individuals only up to about 40% of the poverty level. Only about 40% of the poverty level. In New York, I mean, nationally today, the poverty level for a family of three is about $18,000 a year. So a family of three anywhere in the continental United States making $18,000 or less is at the poverty level. Prior to this Waxman legislation in 1987, 1988, Medicaid on average was only covering people up to about 40% of that level. We're about $8,000 a year for a family of three. You got to be really, really poor. Congress requires the states in 87 to cover pregnant women and infants up to 100% in 1988. Congress requires in 1989 that states should cover pregnant women and kids under the age of 7 up to 133% of the poverty level. And then in 1990, Congress requires states to phase in coverage for all kids up to 100% of the poverty level. So there was a massive, massive spike in enrollment in the late 1980s because of these federal mandates. Medicaid from 1965 to 1985 consistently had about 20 million enrollees the whole time, about 20 million. 65, 70, 75, 80, 85, that whole time about 20 million enrollees. As a result of these federal mandates, though, we go from about 20 million in 1988 to about 40 million 5 years later in 1992, 1993. We double the Medicaid rolls in 4 or 5 years because of these federal mandates. Yeah? All kids who are otherwise eligible, in other words, they meet immigration status, etc., who are in families at 100% of the poverty level or below.
So up to the age of 18?
Well, up to the age of 18. Right, so today in the United States, states are required to cover kids up to the age of 18 who are in families, you know, at 100% of the poverty level or below. And they're required to cover pregnant women and young kids under the age of 7 up to 133% of the poverty level. So there's a massive increase in the number of people on Medicaid in the late 80s, early 90s, which is a very interesting and important political story, as I said, because this took place during an administration, Reagan and then Bush, which is very conservative politically, obviously. There also was a significant increase in the mandate benefits, the benefits that were needed to be provided to these kids. And there were significant new mandates around how states pay safety net providers like public hospitals and community health centers. So the hallmark of this second era of Medicaid, which really took place in the mid-80s until the early 90s, until Bill Clinton comes in, the hallmark of this era is dramatically expanded eligibility, new federal mandates, dramatically expanded costs. I mean, Medicaid in 1988 cost $54 billion nationally. In 1993, it cost $131 billion. So costs escalate dramatically. The benefit package escalates dramatically. Eligibility escalates dramatically, all as a result of these new federal mandates. So the Southern governors, who in 85, 86 were pushing for this option to deal with infant mortality and to have more flexibility in the Medicaid program, the Southern governors and every other governor in the country starts going crazy by the late 80s because there's a recession going on, states' budgets are in terrible shape, state revenue is declining, states' economy are in lousy shape, and Medicaid costs are rising 25-30% a year. So there's huge intergovernmental tension that becomes clear and dominant during this period as well. So first era, 65 to 85, is marked by state discretion and interstate variation. Second era, 85 to 1992, is marked by federal mandates, increased enrollment, increased costs, increased intergovernmental tension. All right, when I look at the clock, and you all also simultaneously look at the clock, you can go. Thanks a lot. So I'll see you next week.